kids for food. Well, the changes moods. Spring's here again.
You're listening to Puck and Roll.
Hello, and welcome to the Puck and Roll podcast. Today, we have a panel with myself, Joshua Rosa, and Aaron Idovich, and we're joined by a very special guest. Sam McGilligan from McKean's Hockey joins us today. Sam, how's it going?
I just muted my mic, and now I'm unmuting it. Hello, how are you?
Doing well. The plan for this episode is not overly structured. It's mainly just focusing on the 2023 draft class and mainly the players that we like quite a bit, that we would rank in the range of our first round. And obviously, Josh and Aaron have also been watching quite a bit of scouting tape this season, so this should be a very fun roundtable discussion about the draft class. To get us started, Sam, throw out a name of a prospect that you will die on the hill of being higher on than anyone else. I think that'd be a fun start.
The only player I can be a candidate for there is Jaden Perron. And even that, I don't know. I don't think this is a year where there's going to be a player that's like so wildly above consensus. That only really happened like last year with Lambert because he's amazing. Like this year, all the top guys are like legitimately amazing. Like everyone in my top five is like almost viewed as like consensus top eight guys outside of Crystal, who might be like viewed a little bit lower by some, but he's top eight by almost everybody as well.
In the public sphere.
Yeah. And then you got, so Jaden Perron would be six, but even that, like if I'm remembering correctly,
I have him at seven.
Yeah. Personally. So you have him at seven. I know Elite Prospects, their U.S. scout, 10. Joey, they have him at 10, oh, yeah. But I know, Joey's higher like
five,
on,
right?
Like, I don't know the number.
Six or something.
I don't know the number. So happy to I don't want to like,
yeah.
Yeah. Like, I don't want to speak for the guy. I don't know the number, but he's smart with this stuff and he has him at six as well. I believe I'm thinking if I heard it right.
Yeah. It's right in that range. I know he has him over like Will Smith and Oliver Moore, and he also really likes those guys. So
I do as well. That's actually the exact same situation.
And so do I. Like I feel like there's a pretty clear top six in this draft class that I don't see changing on my own board for the rest of the season. I know there's one exception there with your board, but I think the other top five guys were also pretty solid on being the top tier, with Connor Bedard alone at one, Fantilli at two, and then a mix of Carlson, Benson, Crystal. And then for me, Mitch Cobb is right in that mix as well. And for you, it's a tier below. But yeah, it's a very fun draft. And off the air, we're talking about how fun it is that this is like the draft for small players. And I think we're all big fans of small players because of how undervalued they are at the draft. So this is a pretty fun draft class for that exact reason.
Yeah, kind of wonder, like, if everyone who is good is small, do they stay undervalued? Like, which players are like, some are gonna slip, but like it's almost gonna be a pick, a guessing game of like, oh, which one's gonna slip? Like,
yeah,
who?
Jaden Perron's gonna slip. So
Jaden Perron is
probably
likely
into
slip.
The second.
I mean, I get a lot of the reasons why people are a bit hesitant on Perron. There is a pretty like standard rule of like, as much as incredible as small players are in junior leagues, it's like if they're 5'8 or less, or 5'9 or less, and they don't meet like a certain skill mobility threshold, they don't play. It's really that cut and dry almost all of the time.
Yeah.
What you're looking for is like the players who are like that on the threshold, just like a tinge below, where you know they can get faster, you know they can get more skilled, especially the speed thing when they're like super underdeveloped. Perron, like,
if
is just
a way he could get the same growth chart Lane Hutson had that says, like, I can be 5'10 Monday.
That's an exception, but
I'm a big boy.
Perron's not even a guy who, like, needs his size, which is interesting because interior players like that often, like, guys who come off the wall and cut inside and are really, really good at it are often the ones who get away with being a bit smaller. Like, being playing in the interior as much as he does is can be a real big, like, he's just getting banged up and thrown around style of play. But Perron's entire game is built around escaping those situations and not having to go to the wall for it. It's extremely high level stuff. Like,
yeah,
that's what makes him so exceptional to me. And it's because, like, some of the plays I've seen him just engineer are some of the best plays I've seen all year from anybody. They are as high level as you can find. He is sitting there spinning off of pressure one way, right into a second guy, baiting his stick to the left before moving to the right, and then hook passing it around him, like, through a third target to a cross slot shot that didn't end up being a goal. It was really tragic. But, like, it's plays like that where it's just like, whoa, why? It's not troubleshooting it either, where, like, he's just, like, seeing it as it's happening and going, like, like, making a move because it's, like, a smart read to pressure that he wasn't accounting for. It's like Perron, his whole game is built around just, like, manipulate one way, pressure comes this way, but I'm ready for it, manipulate him this way so I can get around him, then make the play. And it's like, that's about as high level as you can get. Now, I mean, there's a lot of shifts and stuff like that where he just doesn't do it. There are games where he's not scoring as much. His production isn't as high as people want it to be, especially for Chicago Steel standards. The Chicago Steel aren't playing to Chicago Steel standards this year. Yeah. So it's like, it's a bit cut and dry. I think what you need to do is, like, look at the high end plays you can pull off with Celebrini. And it's just like, hey, well, I can see you pulling that off with other NHLers. Like, that's not, like, one of those, like, you're just taking advantage of bad defenders, which they do. Of course they do. Like, that's what you want
to
see.
The USHL, you have to. Yeah.
It's like junior leagues. Like, if you're not taking advantage of the bad defenders, and, like, what are you doing? But, like, they're able to do it against, like, set defenses, making the right rotations, and they're able to just deconstruct it layer by layer. And Perron's Celebrini. So I wouldn't say he's an equal contributor, but, like, he's as high end a contributor at sometimes. He lacks the consistency, and Celebrini brings a larger game elsewhere. Perron's also, like, insane in transition. In theory, yes. Some games he has meh. I think Scouch's data has some, like, surprisingly, like, the efficiency wasn't what I was expecting it to be. But again, it's like the high level stuff when it happens. It's incredible. And it's all in the middle of the ice. Like, he's just not a perimeter player. And though it's the perimeter players who are so reliant on cutting in, like, their game has to be perfect for me to think that it's going to, like, carry over. And if it doesn't carry over, it's like, what are they going to be then? But Perron kind of passes all this test, so there's a lot of risk. But, like, I love this kid. Like, he's probably my second or third favorite in the whole draft.
Like, when it comes to a lot of risk, he's going to have a Lane Hutson-style trajectory in the draft, where at a certain point, it's a lot of risk. But once you're in, like, the mid-second round, a lot of players are a lot of risk.
Yeah.
You never really know.
Yeah.
And the standard, like, of player at that point is, right? Like, I mean, like in the last draft, we saw guys like Artem Duda go at, like, 35th overall, right? Like, when you're seeing those types of picks happen, passing on a guy like Lane Hutson, or did Duda go ahead of Furkus, or, like, one pick behind?
Duda,
either way, like, same range.
Okay, so same range.
Yeah. But if you're passing on, like, guys like Gleb Trikazov and even, like, Kalia Delius and Lane Hutson, to pick an Artem Duda,
Sikora.
Right? Like,
Sikora,
it's not less of an upside question there, right? But even then, if you want to play it safe in the second round, yeah, like you don't go Duda, you go
like,
Sikora, right?
I will never get so over how badly Arizona used those picks after how badly
San Jose
used those picks after making that trade.
I mean, yeah, and Arizona also drafted not great.
Yeah.
I like the Julian Lutz pick, but that was about it in the second round. But going back to Perron for one last point, like, the thing that immediately struck me with Perron, because after my first two viewings, I wasn't, like, enamored with him. I remember Sam, like we were talking about this, And you're like, give him another try. And I watched one more game, and that game was the one where he started actually showing like everything that he could do. But the one thing that was so consistent in like all of my viewings of Perron is just the dynamism of his off puck movement all over the ice.
Oh, like, that's the other thing. I didn't even mention that one.
If it's the offensive zone off puck or defensive zone in coverage, he knows exactly where to be. He knows how to lose defenders. He knows how to hit the blind spots. He's constantly moving, and it's so purposeful and so conscious. Like he doesn't stumble into open ice. He creates it. Like he creates his own open space by dragging defenders out a bit wider and then attacking the middle. Right. He's so middle oriented. And that was something that was amazing.
Coaches love him. Like that, there's he's the type of small player that a coach genuinely likes. Like Logan Stankoven is very similar in terms of his off puck movement. I mean, Stankoven plays with a bit more of that intensity, and he's also just a bit more of a pest.
And if we're talking like Stankoven, I'd bring like Gavin Brindley's name into the equation.
That
intensity
just about to go the direction with Perron. Perron and Brindley do it in like different ways, but
Stankoven's a lot bigger than Perron just in like stockiness. Like I believe Stankoven's 5'8", 173.
Perron, like his listed weight went from like 143 up to like 165.
Yeah, okay. Jaden Perron is 142 pounds wet.
He plays for Chicago Steel. Like he's undeniably getting stronger throughout the year. Like that is a top
lot bigger
that's
now
a,
than he was in September. Like a
like
lot.
That's
bigger.
A top tier program in like every possible measure you can look at. So like I have full faith in like what they're doing with him developmentally. I think a thing with Perron, just like adding on to the off puck movement point, is like he's so dynamic away from the puck, like you said, he's so purposeful, but he doesn't over skate at the same time. There's such a fine line between like high active players off the puck who can't recognize when they've just left the pocket that was most valuable because they were too
like Brindley,
the puck
right? Like Brindley's a guy that needs to learn to slow down a little bit. Sometimes.
Brindley
like,
could use some pace adjustments, but more, I kind of
more
think
on the
Michigan...
puck. I'm thinking more on the puck with him, on the puck. It's more a thing of he's not as deceptive as he could be if he just learned to slow down sometimes because he's constantly going full throttle.
Yeah, I think part of that is Brindley's game, and I think another part of that is like that's what Michigan wants of him because he can.
That's fair.
Like he can slow down. Like you'll see it in little flashes. Like he'll slow down when it's like the super.
He did
it
a lot
obvious.
More during the World Juniors.
Yeah,
did
and
a
I was just
more.
About to say like when you saw Brindley at the World Juniors and they actually like moved. I was floored he made the team. I wanted him
me
to
too.
Make the team. I was like he should, but I couldn't believe he actually did. I was so happy. Then I immediately thought of like 2020 Cole Caulfield when they were like go on the fourth. line and bang on some boards and call it Caulfield did terrible.
And go bumper on the power play.
But I was like, Brindley plays in Michigan and he plays against like these, he plays that style of game. Like he can forecheck, he can make plays off the forecheck. Like he's small, but he's strong, he's sturdy, he gets really good center of gravity, great posture when he's like protecting the puck. He reach isn't exceptional, but he uses it. Like he knows what he's doing with it. And he's got that small area manipulation when he's using his reach and he can combine it with like those sharp turns and it can lead to some insane stuff. Like Brindley's potential is like through the roof of like what he could be. I don't know if he will be because like what he does with Michigan kind of and like how he's being developed as a player like kind of contradicts with the whole like you could be a dynamo offensive superstar, but it's also like what makes Brindley so much more projectable anyways, because you're just like, you know, he plays pro style hockey for a small guy, but still has the skill and mobility to learn how to be more dynamic offensively. You pair him with the right guys in the NHL, Brindley will do really well, but I don't think you want him like being the guy on your top six, but you want him in your second line playing with your really good to see who's more of a line driver.
Yeah.
Whereas like Perron, you can legitimately see him on the first line, but you can also straight up see him not in the NHL, which is kind of why like this is where like ranking Perron six almost becomes like a philosophical thing of like, what are you building your list for? Like, are you building it for NHL teams? Or are you building it as if you were in charge? Like if I'm walking up to a podium, that means I have ownership of ownership is not the right word. I'd have Perron's rights. Like I have Perron as a player I am also involved with the organization that's developing him. If I'm not doing it, I know who is doing it, so I know whether or not they can do it. If I'm walking up to the stadium, I'm getting to the front, and I say Jaden Perron's name at 6th overall because my top five are gone, then I have a development team that's looked at him, and they're like, yeah, we can do it. And then I don't, like, that's kind of the flaw. Like, I won't give up on Perron because he's small. If my coach is, like, benching him, I'm going to be like, dude, what the hell? I spent a 6th overall pick on him, and he's disgusting. Can you stop with that? Until he's legitimately bad, and the coach is right.
If you're an NHL GM, you know that if you're picking at 6 and you're picking at 38, you're probably going to be able to get him to 38. Because teams just...
I just mean more in like you're getting
into the meta of rankings at this point too, right? Because it's also a difference between your actual rankings and who you pick, right? Exercise that I know that we both do is on draft day we make the picks that we would instead of the Habs, right?
Yes, like, I've got 3 years of that. I still don't know how I feel about my team.
Mine's looking up. Mine's looking okay,
but like you can't judge it until it's 5 years.
No, exactly.
So a bunch of these guys are going to suck, and then someone you passed on is randomly like that dude. I was
this close to picking Devin Levy, and it's killing me. I was like a hair away from picking him.
I can one up you on that. I took Anton Johannesson as the one guy I had above Sean Farrell at the pick that we took Sean Farrell with.
I also had Johannesson ahead of Farrell, but I picked both of them ahead of where Sean Farrell went.
I need to look at my 2020 again, but that one pissed me off because I was mad when I made the pick. I was like, I basically flipped a coin in my head and I was like, Swedish guy. And then went with that. And then he decided to spend the next few years of his career hurt.
So yeah. It's the injuries that sucks. That really. Yeah,
Sean Farrell.
The latter years of the Bergevin era made some picks that
we can. I don't even want to get into the.
Well, it's okay because like all years of the Bergevin era made some questionable picks. Like the one, like
Joshua never should have turned out the way he did.
That was a good pick, at that point in the draft, that was a solid swing.
I don't remember who I took, but it was like I remember thinking like, yeah, Habs took Waugh. I took this guy. I'm slightly more interested, but Waugh's fine here. Like I think Waugh would have been fine.
I think I took Lucas Gustafsson with that pick.
I don't remember who I took. I'm gonna check. You've got my curiosity going.
But where I was going with bringing this up in the first place was just by saying that like rankings and where you and who you pick don't necessarily like actually align. So
yes,
with the 33rd pick for the Habs in 2022, my top ranked player available was Lane Hutson. I did not pick Lane Hutson with that pick. I picked Jagr Furkus because I was banking on Hutson falling to 62, which he did, which was a risk. But that way I got both of them and I'm very happy I did. So it turned out worthwhile. It was definitely worthwhile in the end, but yeah, like you have to in the end make your bets, but there's so many players worth it. It is a coin flip, right? Like for me, it was also like, okay, I love Jagr Furkus. I love Lane Hutson. Who do I think falls here? Because that's my only, like, I don't know how else to like make a decision here. So I'm just going to hope and pray that Lane Hutson falls, and he did.
I did the same thing. I was hoping to go right Lambert, Furkus, Hutson.
Yeah.
Hutson and Kalliodelius around the same time, and then hopefully some team still hadn't watched Gleb, and I could snag him there. Gleb went to Carolina.
Yeah.
Brilliant bastards.
Carolina, the fact that they got Gleb and Grudinin in that draft killed. The Habs drafted Jared Davidson ahead of Grudinin. Like that brings me pain.
Well ahead of Grudinin.
Yeah. Well ahead of Grudinin.
Fun fact, I actually took with the 60th pick at the draft Kalliodelius until I realized I'm like, wait, I don't think Montreal picks as soon as I thought they did. So I deleted the tweet. And took Hutson, and then like 5 seconds later, it was like the Habs take Hutson, and I was like, I had the
exact same thing because I was live streaming the draft, So the Habs are on the clock, and I'm like, oh, Adelius Hudson. I'll go Lane Hudson. I write down, look up, and the first thing I see, Habs like Lane Hudson on the draft. I'm like,
we also traded 65 at the draft.
That's the what it was. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's why, because I'm looking at this, I'm like, wait, there was a 15 pick difference. I feel like that's not what it was when I made this decision. Because I swear like, I was going 65
and 98 at the draft.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds more.
But that I sounds remember a lot for more Sebastian's familiar. Live stream, it happened to be in Montreal that all of the Canadian phone providers just blacked out that day.
Yep.
So I had no service. I was on the Tim Hortons Bell Center Wi-Fi. And I came on the live stream, and I'm like, "Oh my god!"
And we just celebrated.
The Habs.
It was a good day. It was a very good day.
I didn't even know about the pick when I was there. I was in the back somewhere, and I was talking.
Oh my god!
Like I made the pick, and when I was in the middle of a conversation, I was like, "Sorry, I have to do this like before the pick is made." And then I kind of went back to the conversation, and then I kind of just walked out, and I was like, "Who'd the Habs take?" And I saw Hudson. I swear it was a cartoon Looney Tunes, just jaw drop into the floor.
Yeah, it was very
literally was trying to run around, like try not run around giddy as hell that it happened. It was most satisfying draft pick I've ever heard, I'm pretty sure, in my entire life.
That never and Cole Caulfield.
And I'm so actually Cole Caulfield, I legitimately jumped up and like arms in the air.
I like, wish I was into hockey when that happened.
Such a good day. That was such a good day.
And I was
day.
So sad when we didn't get Quinn Hughes or Zadina in 2018.
Except now, whenever I think of the Caulfield pick, I think of Cam York, who I traded 1-for-1 in fantasy with new number one defenseman Vince Dunn.
Yeah, it really
burns. And you told me to do it, Sebastian. So
I don't even remember that, but sure. Yeah, that was a while ago. Other players in the 2023 draft class that could be interesting topics. The first name that comes to mind is the player that me and Sam have been talking about for like months on end, David Reinbacher, who is now like very close in our rankings. Like I have him at 29 and he's at 34 on your board. So after all that deliberation, he's basically in the same range in both of our drafts now. But he is being discussed as a top 15 guy by a lot of people.
Yeah.
Which I don't see.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why. There's a reason why he's being talked about in the top 15.
He's the kind of guy. He's a very safe. He's a very safe pick. Like, and I know Sam's going to be a bit like, you know, I don't think you're fully on board with the safety of the pick.
No, I get the safety of the pick. He's Austrian, slightly less effective Caden Gooley. Like draft year Caden Gooley, like that's kind of
the same. He
without the killer instinct that Gooley has that sends people like 18 rows up every time he breathes in their direction. Like, but more so just towards the boards and trying to hit them. But he's on bigger ice, so it doesn't work as well or look the same.
Yeah, I think one issue I have with Reinbacher's game that was like an eyesore for me during the World Juniors is his handling skill. He has this like often this really awkward posture while handling the puck, but almost like his arm up almost over his shoulder, and it looks uncomfortable and is incredibly ineffective. He can't do anything with it. He locks himself in with his top hand fully, and it just like basically just juggles the puck in front of him on his way up the ice. He's far more effective as a passer in transition than a carrier. And even then, under direct pressure, he can kind of fumble the puck a bit in the breakout. But yeah, I don't see the upside to justify having him top 20 just yet. And I know some people are talking about him top 15. And I don't see it. I think he's a number 4 defenseman if he turns out. And that's good. He's a good player. But I don't see him in the same conversation with defensemen with other guys that are available in this class. Like I think Axel Sandin-Pellikka has really like separated himself from the other defensemen available in the draft class. And Dmitry Simashev is Reinbacher with better tools, as you told me already multiple times, Sam.
Yeah.
Which I do very much agree with, because yeah, he's a better skater than Reinbacher. He has better handling skill. He's a more dynamic skater.
He's a significantly better defender. And I don't mean this as a slight to Reinbacher, but more so,
for sure.
Like, I'm not sure the last time I watched a defender like impress me that much with his stick in the defensive zone as Simashev does. And I'm just like, and he's not just a defensive stick. Like, he's got so much more to his game. But like, that's,
yeah,
that's like, oh boy, he's just...
He's very good.
He's so good. And I still haven't seen the best of what he has to offer yet, which is kind of nuts, because there's a few people I've talked to who are just like, yeah, I've seen him do this and this. I'm like, you've seen him do what? Okay. Like, that's approaching top, like, eight territory. Like, if I start seeing Simashev busting out, like, deceptive hook passes through the ozone and like
activating off the point. I had one viewing where he was playing almost Denton Mateychuk style offensive hockey, and I had a blast. He generated 0 points, but by my eye test, his expected primary assists would have been at like 1.5 for that game.
I love Denton.
Denton. Oh yeah, so do I.
Columbus just had themselves a first round.
Yeah, I mean, David Yiracek is having quite the B+1 season. Yeah, but yeah, like Simashev, like the first game I watched of Simashev, everyone that I'd been talking to about him beforehand was like, oh yeah, he's so great defensively. Offensive game isn't the selling point. And that first game is the one where he just blew me away offensively specifically. And I was like, who is this guy? How does he have one assist on the season?
Yeah, with this tool in the really NHL. Unlucky.
Yeah, same with like Timur Mukhanov, right?
Mukhanov, I swear, in just like the hand, no player I've seen in the first round less than Timur Mukhanov, I'm pretty sure. But like every game I see him, I'm like, I think you should have at least 5 points in the three games I've seen. Like, yeah. If we're talking, like, if you had luck going your way, you'd have 6 for sure. Luck balances itself out, but like you had five, he had made 5 plays in those three games where I'm like, that wasn't in what? Like he took on the entire other team at one point, just cut right through. It was kind of like the Bedard overtime winner at the World Juniors, the exact same style of moves where he just like kind of like bobbed in and out and then didn't score on his. And I was like, what the holy. I mean, like,
yeah.
I was like, putting off his viewings all year.
Like, Mukhanov to me is like the Russian Gavin Brindley in a sense, like that ultra high pace.
Yeah,
lacks a really threatening shot, but flashes some very impressive playmaking ability. Yes. And the speed is just off the charts. Like his motor. Like I think those of the players I've watched in this draft class, those are the two players with the best motors in the class. Like. Just unrelenting.
Yeah.
Is it like, I mean, are there any other contenders? Gavin Brindley, like, yeah.
Was his motor is like an electric car with just like instant torque and a battery that never dies.
Yeah.
He's on it all the time.
Yeah. And Mukhanov too. Like Mukhanov just like sprints his entire shifts and seemingly does not get tired, even in the games where he plays a lot of minutes. But
a bit of a freak of nature like that.
He's fun. I like him a lot.
I do too. I'm growing more and more of a fan of his as I watch him. I just like, I'm still in small sample territory to the point where like I feel uncomfortable having him at 18. Because like there are guys I've seen more of behind him who I like just about as much. But it's a bit of like in the three games I've seen, he's been absurd and probably should be scoring much more, and I'm gonna do more to figure out what's up. But like, if he's just having like the unluckiest season of all time, then he moving up. Like, he's not a dude who he's one of the hardest cases of a player not scoring I've ever seen. Like, even Brad Lambert, you could figure out why, but like Mukhanov is like consistent. Like, dangerous stuff is happening all the time. Nothing is going in. Yeah. What is going on?
Like I've mentioned before, that on my rankings, I have the numbers that update automatically, but it's a very faulty system. And this happened for Simashev, where I saw 15 games played, 0 goals, 0 assists, 0 points. I'm like, oh, there must have been a mistake because I'd watched two games of him thus far. Like at that point, I've now watched 3, which that's a pretty big sample for me. I don't have that kind of commitment. But I knew he didn't score in those 2 games, but like I watched his game, like he has to be at least half a point. And I went to go double check, like, which actually
consistently produces. Like he creates so many chances, but
to the credit
kind of like Mukhanov, no one
automatically ranking stuff, double checking every single number to make sure it's right, probably takes longer than just putting it in auto like manually.
Yeah.
But I digress. It's cool when the numbers move.
Eh, I get it.
Makes sense. While this episode is definitely focusing on the 17-year-olds playing hockey, let's focus on the sport where a 45-year-old just got thrown out of the playoffs, football.
The NFL playoff action continues. We're one step closer to Super Bowl 57 and the NFL divisional round. Check out DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. New customers can bet just $5 and get 200 in free bets instantly. Plus, all new and exciting customers can take a shot at an even bigger payout with DraftKings stepped up same game parlays. Boost your NFL winnings with each leg you add up to 100%.
While 20% may be the average power play conversion percentage, it was also the conversion percentage of the Dallas Cowboys for the extra points in their games against the Bucks.
I mean, I got to cheer for the 49ers because I love Brock Purdy. Okay. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code THPN. New customers can bet $5 on the NFL divisional round and get 200 in free bets instantly. Only at DraftKings Sportsbook with code THPN. Minimum age and eligibility restrictions apply. See show notes for details.
All right. So David Reinbacher, who, as we were mentioning before, is a bit of a divisive prospect all of a sudden. He kind of was a bit unknown up until like late October, early November. Was not getting talked about much at all, and suddenly is potentially going to be the first defender off the board on draft day and is rocketing up basically every draft board. And I know that Sam, that we've been talking about him for months at this point, and we started off seeing very different things, but now he's basically at the same like spot in our respective rankings. So what do you see in Reinbacher, and what are your reservations with having him above guys like Simashev?
It's the easiest way of putting this together. David Reinbacher will play in the NHL. David Reinbacher will be most likely a quality third pairing guy. Like one you're very happy to have on that pairing, not one where you're just like, oh, whatever. I mean, you can grab him off waivers. He's physical. He's got good timing defensively. And the prettiest part of his game typically comes from breakout passes. They don't often come under pressure. Like I've seen him cough up a lot of pucks under pressure, especially on D zone retrievals. But if he manages to get through, the first pass is often like the right first pass, not like just like a pass to be made, but like it's a good one. Like he's even impressed some of the passes he's made where I'm just like, oh, I didn't know you had that in him. The part with Reinbacher that I don't see so far is that all of his offensive, his World Junior tape is almost like a prototypical example of why I personally just don't view World Junior tape too much unless it meets like certain circumstances. That sounds like it can be subject to bias, and maybe it is, but Reinbacher played for Austria. They either only got destroyed or they only did well against bad teams. And there was like no middle ground on that kind of. They either got absolutely shellacked against Sweden and Canada, or they got their successful games against Latvia and I believe it was Germany. Started like what teams played what are starting to blend together in my head already, but he did really well in the game against Latvia. That was the one that really stood out to me. He was activating. He was doing everything that everybody is saying. Like these are parts of his game that he just can't show. He was doing all of it and more, and he looked really good. And from what I've seen, all of the track data coming out of that game was incredible. It's just it's Latvia. You kind of want to see that. That's like, it's not that it's an amazing indicator that it's there. It's that it's one of those like, oy, if it's not there kind of deals. He plays Swiss League, which is, now that I've seen more of it, it's not a league I've watched too much in recent years. It's a better league than I thought. But it's still one of those, like, it's not an environment where you kind of get to see him develop these skills all too much. It's very likely that he comes over sooner than you'd expect. Most teams are going to bring him over as soon as he seems capable of playing like a third pairing role, which will probably be on like 2 years. He's quick. He's big. He can angle guys off. His defensive stick isn't bad. And he's got pretty solid timing on some plays. Most plays in the defensive zone. Beyond that, I don't really see all too much for him to be a top 20, top 15 guy. I can't do it over Luca Cagnoni, who is quicker, much shiftier. One of the, like, shifty's a word that's used a lot with like any lateral player, like anyone who just moves laterally, but Cagnoni actually is shifty, and he's like super composed when he's facilitating breakouts. I can't take him over Gulyayev. It just becomes like it in the list just goes one by one of like the guys with the upside. Like Caden Price might not play in the NHL. Reimbacher will. If you're looking for a body, you're not taking Caden Price. But I want to take Caden Price ahead of him, because Caden Price's toolkit is absurd and boasts like real number two, number three upside. It is crazy what that guy can do. Reimbacher, not so much, unless you see development come through with the skills. And at times, like there's times when he's in motion and it's like he has puck control where he can then do nice plays. But in the NHL, the biggest thing is like, how quick do you get that puck control? Because you have milliseconds before somebody is on you. Like, it really is a game of millimeters and milliseconds. Like, you don't have time. If you don't have complete control to make the pass you need to as you're corralling the puck, you've already lost the possession. You're going to get sent to the moon if you have to take a second to be like, where's the puck again? Someone is just going to yeet you into the wall or something like that. Hell, half the time it might even be dirty and no one's going to call it. Like, this is where the Reimbacher is just like, it's an identity thing. It's like, you can theoretically develop him into a top four guy. It's risky, but it's possible. There might be guys who work development who'd be able to say it's not as risky as I think. And I'd revisit the conversation if that's the case. Just from what I know, it feels like it's a bit of a risk, mostly just because like I'm looking at other names in the area. This is just a loaded draft.
Yeah.
You can find 32 players who are skilled, drive play, do have something to offer that leads to real NHL upside with safety, and not have to worry too much about like, well, do I want to just develop him for what he is now and definitely get a player out of him? Or do I want to like start changing core aspects of his game to try and create more? Unless you can like be like, I can fix every bit of the handling issue and make him a handling god. It's like, okay. But then at that point, it's like, once you start making assumptions like that, it's like, okay, well, why Reimbacher? Why only him? Why not all of the other players in that range? It's like,
looking to take on that kind of challenge is going to take a different player.
Yeah. Unless they have like a specific team member who is looking at Reimbacher and being like, no, I promise you, I can do this. And that happens. And that's how a lot of these exceptions where you're just like at the time of the draft, you're like, eh, and then they turn out to be pretty good. And they're like, well, they just didn't have that in their game before. It's like, well, that was probably some development staff guy knowing what he was getting himself into. But with this one, it's just like personally, based on the other players available, based on what Reimbacher currently has as a player, based on like what you want from a top 15, top 20 player. I don't know. William Whitelaw might not play in the NHL. William Whitelaw might be a first line 30 goal, 50 like
he's insane.
35 goal score. Like, it's
the tools are easily top 10 in the class. Like without a shadow of a doubt. Yeah. Whitelaw's tools are incredible.
There's quite a few players. Like, that's where I'm looking at it. It's just like they're more.
He's another guy, just like Perron, that's going to drop so far to the point where...
Oh, yeah. Whitelaw's going to be available late in the draft. But the thing is, with him, I understand it a lot more than with Perron in terms of falling. Like,
yes.
William Whitelaw, at his worst, is incredibly inefficient, purely perimeter-based, and incredibly individualistic. Like, that is... There is a lot there that needs to change. The physicality of the game is overwhelming him regularly in the USHL of all leagues, which is concerning. His decision making is inconsistent. He just is inconsistent. He will flash
just like
tremendous skill.
But if you're talking like a fifth, sixth round pick, he's just as risky as most of the guys there.
Oh no! Like once you hit like the second round, Whitelaw, like the risk reward threshold has been crossed. But like,
same thing with Hudson, right? Like
at some point players, it just becomes like, all right, like, man, what are you doing?
Exactly.
Like at a certain point, it's such a long shot already. Go for the long shot that can
for sure. And also, like what would you rather take a home run swing on a guy that's either going to be a top six forward or non NHLer, or a swing or bunt on a guy who is likely going to be a fourth liner? Like at that point, why are you taking what? Why? What's the point?
It's
of
like, what
draft
do you just
pick?
Want with a draft pick?
You pick him off of waivers, right? Like at any point.
Yeah, exactly.
Season,
I was about to
like
say,
a Michael McCarron was on waivers today. Ely Tolvanen was on waivers a few weeks ago, which was absurd.
Ely Tolvanen's not a fourth line winger, but
no, exactly. But like you have options to fill out your bottom six and your bottom pairing in free agency on waivers, right? Consistently. So what I don't understand is teams drafting players who are so clearly limited to those types of projections with high draft picks. Like, sure, if you're picking them in like the later rounds and you want to get those types of players on ELCs and have them controlled under team control for what, 9 years, fine. Yeah, fine. Like, sure, go for it. Like late rounds is a free-for-all. Like at that point, like
Tyler Boucher was just,
yeah, that was a
pure, like I'll always go back to that one, but it's not the only one of its kind. Like
no, exactly. Like
it might have been the most extreme draft. But...
Yeah, we see it in every draft where players are picked when they really shouldn't be, right?
I can't really think of one in 21. Like Nolan
Allen at 31. Yeah.
Oh, not 21, 2022.
Artem Duda was the one I was talking about earlier.
Well, once you're out of the first, it's like...
Yeah, sure. Okay, but even inside the
Korchinski went a lot higher than I thought, yeah, but he looks good.
But that was a swing, right? Like, with Korchinski, you're swinging on something tangible. Like, I was not high on Korchinski, right?
Like,
but you
Gautier
are swinging
went
on upside. Gautier at five is... Yeah, sure. Like, on upside, yeah. It's not the biggest of swings. But there definitely were names that were kind of bunts in the draft that I remember that I can't remember.
I
for
mean,
some reason. Let's
did
see.
Did Lamoureux go in the first round?
Yep, Lamoureux went 29.
Yeah.
Okay. Reed Schaefer 32. Reed Schaefer
was
a
that
bunt
was
for
happen.
Edmonton.
Who went at 25?
Nathan Gauthier at 22. I mean, that's just ultra safe. Like, I understand that more than Lamoureux Schaefer, but still.
Teams will just, like, defer to... It's from what I get from the way the NHL does it, it's less about, like, knowing... A lot of the guys we identify as upside picks are teams know won't work with their system. They're guys...
Oh, for
like,
sure.
Like, it doesn't matter. I guess I can't say for sure, it doesn't matter, but I've always wondered, like, if I'm sitting there and I'm a general manager and I like a player, my head scout is pretty interested in him, but he's got other guys. And then I talk the development stuff. I'm like, what do you think about this? And the development guy who I know is going to be working with him is like, nope. Even if another team has a guy who's like, absolutely, you don't have that guy working for you. You have this guy. You're not going to change your development staff over one player that's extremely inefficient and likely to harm you more than anything else. You're just going to be like, oh, shit. All right, next on the list. Sometimes guys like Gauthier as well, like, we've I agree with you guys where I was like, I saw him as like a, yeah, it made sense. It's like a big bot. He plays big. He's a, like, you can see him on a third line and like
he's a guaranteed bottom six forward. He's going to make the NHL.
There's a difference between a fourth line center and a really good third line center.
Oh, the massive difference. Huge.
Yeah, like you're not going to see six a guy players like Boucher aren't on waivers. Bad. Like that's no, exactly. The,
yeah,
I people hear bottom six and first round and immediately that's why I guess I say middle six instead of bottom six, where it's like,
yeah,
ideally if you were like winning a Stanley Cup level good, you want them on the third line, but you can still completely be fine with them on your second as long as they're not the main guy. So yeah. I guess for centers it's a little less lenient because you need two amazing wingers to really play and make up for the fact that center is a more valuable position. But like with wingers, especially on the third line, it's just like you throw them on the second line, just throw them up there. They're fine. Someone gets hurt and they move up. Do they look that out of place? No, it's fine. Like they're most of these guys are going to end up playing top six at some point in their career. Maybe if they don't stick, but I get why teams go for them more and more every year as more and more of the creative ideas I had when like watching players and viewing them and seeing them and being like, no, I'd take this risk in the first. And then I look back, I'm like, and I would have been wrong. Interesting. And it's just lesson learned. And then I get it. I still don't, but I still like, obviously I cater more to this style of thinking with where we go back to like, it's still a draft pick. I'm going for upside. Like I'm not trying to.
Yeah.
You can,
because you know the bottom six guys are going to come on waivers. Like I made a tweet about it, how you could have had like an insane bottom pairing of whatever his name is in Kovacevic, whoever Arizona got.
Problem with Malamaki. That is you can't build
Malamaki, Kovacevic,
and then
a fourth line of Tolvanen, Phillips, and someone in the center, I guess.
Yeah, that which is true, Costin's but you can't
good.
Rely. A, if you use a waiver, you're now at the back of the order. B,
yeah,
the biggest problem with it is that you just can't look at waivers and be like, eventually someone will come and fill my gigantic hole I left on the fourth line. Like you have to be proactive when making moves, because if you don't, the NHL, like NHL GMs know how to play off of each other really well. That's like an underrated part that doesn't even get like a captured in fantasy properly, is like how well these guys understand the market. Even the ones who we look at as bad, mostly, even if let's just make the assumption that they're bad and they probably aren't, but like let's just do it. There's other people in that front office with massive influence who aren't.
Yeah,
like, everybody kind of like gets how it works. So if you leave a gigantic hole on the fourth line, you're waiting for a waiver to come and fix that. Someone, if they want him slightly more than you, will throw the fifth round pick there and they'll just like be anticipating your move the whole time and just will make the deal ahead of time. There's all these little factors that never show up or in trade talks and trade rumors and things like this. That
I just can't believe that Eli Tolvanen couldn't get a fourth or a fifth. Like,
yeah, sometimes a decision like this gets made and you're just like, holy shit. And like sometimes once you're just like, wow, it's just like, because you can't tell when it's going to happen, you can't rely on it. No GM is going to use it. And then most of the time when they go on waivers, everyone's like, do we have like everything we need to make this work? And most teams are going to be like, no, why is he being waived? And like, I mean, what is happening over like, in that office?
Oh no, we don't have $1.4 million of cap space. Move on. So
it's partly that. It's the roster spot. Who gets sent down? It's like, does this mess up? Even if the issues can be traced back to like, well, it was Eli Tolvanen, it was worth the risk. I mean, like before Tolvanen went to Seattle, I was sitting there like, he was legitimately one of the textbook examples I had of like being wrong in the first round. And now suddenly he's just like playing like that player that I thought I was. So like, I don't know, but like, I don't know if I would have like moved heaven and earth to get Tolvanen. And if it worked, it worked. If it didn't, I would have been like,
yeah.
Okay. Shit.
It's more for a team like the Buffalo Sabres, for instance, who have,
yes,
$14 million in cap space, and
those are the teams offense. That can be like,
and they're pushing for the playoffs, right? Like, like a team like Buffalo had no reason not to claim Tolvanen, and it's more for those cases, right? It's not like if a team has literally $0 in cap space. That's not.
I think the Seattle Kraken are going to win the Stanley Cup. Like
that's my take
of the night.
That is a.
I think the Seattle Kraken are going to win the Stanley Cup.
Because it's been a nice hot run. I don't know.
It's going to be Boston. It's going to make me depressed.
Yeah, Boston.
Oh, no, Boston's definitely going to be. Boston's going to find a way to get Horvat. That's out there now. But Seattle, they have like 3 second-round picks that are worth a ton in this year's draft.
That's true.
And they have, at the deadline, they're going to have like $10.8 million of accrued cap space. That's so much cap space.
Yeah, but I don't know if that's enough. The playoffs are brutal.
Yeah,
but regular season is higher season.
Their goal differential has been fantastic. And their competition in the West isn't going to be as bad as Bruins' competition in the East.
I don't disagree with any of this, but like...
And
if they ever meet in the final, if they're meeting in the final, though, like...
It's a toss-up. Like, I mean, look at how Seattle played that last game.
Look at how Seattle played against...
Yeah, it was one game. We're talking about seven here.
How did the Habs play
a couple games ago? Oh, they had one good game. Playoff contenders.
It's playoff hockey is like
game road trip.
Yes,
playoff hockey is just
a hot.
They have that dog in them.
You can't.
New Jersey had a 13-game win streak earlier this season, right? Like teams go hot. It happens. Boston's just Linus Ullmark is like 24-1-2. Even better. Yeah, 1-2. Like, I don't know. I would put money on Seattle.
You want to know what my take is for the cup?
What?
It's going to be the Leafs.
No. We're not making it out of the first.
Going to be Toronto the day they lost in the playoffs last year. And I've never once said anything but, Toronto's losing in the first again. Up until the day they lost last year. And I'm like, that's it. They were legitimately the better team. They probably should have won that playoff series. That's the type of like mental break that you need to do it the next year. And when they win, the momentum ride they're going to get will trounce everything in the path, so long as they get the goaltending. I have no fucking clue if they're getting the goaltending. I don't trust.
All depends if Samsonov stays healthy. Like Matt Murray is a lottery. Like you don't know what you're getting with him in the playoffs.
Yeah, assuming
the two games I watched in Tampa Bay was the greatest live hockey I have ever seen. That team knows itself so well. They're built for the playoffs.
That team is tired.
That team isn't tired.
That team is tired.
Stamkos has another like 15 years in him. He can play until he's 47. I don't care.
That team is good enough to like overcome this, but like that team has been through some shit the last 3 years. They have gone through three cup
runs,
final runs. Any team that's ever got like, who was it? Was it the Warriors? I think it was the Warriors. Draymond Green was talking about it. The finals runs just exhausted them, and they basically, and the Tampa can do it as well, they basically just kept relying on each other to keep boosting momentum, because if like somebody fell, then the whole stretch of dominoes is going to everybody. Like your body doesn't get a chance to recover as well, but it's not even so much that you don't get an off season when you do three straight cup final runs. You get like once a cup end versus preseason, so it's like 2 months maybe. Your body is you are broken those 2 months. Even if you do go out and you're posting Instagram pictures of them on vacation and stuff like that, they're probably limping around. They've got broken bones, torn muscles. Everything hurts. Best case scenarios, some guy comes out.
Zach Bogosian on the first pairing playing amazing. You replace Ryan McDonough with Nick Perbix and you become a better team. Like they're...
Are they better
wagon?
They're a better
team. Are they a better team?
Nick Perbix played two straight, like, number one D games. He played, like, 19 minutes a game, and he was perfect.
19 minutes a game isn't number one D minute.
But 19 minutes a game in a game that had, like, seven power plays. So,
yeah, I mean, look, like
he was perfect.
I'm not I'm not the biggest. Look, Perbix, I feel, is like the Jan Rudolph replacement of just like your plug and play second pairing guy that gets the job done. He's not the Ryan McDonough replacement.
Brandon Hagel is insane.
Which he better be with the price they paid to get Hagel. Like,
he is looking exceptional right now.
He is looking very
funny. Tampa, obviously, like Tampa goes far. No one is surprised. It's just at some point, with every year that goes by, the odds that it catches up to them is just larger larger and larger. Chicago was a wagon until St. Louis, and that was in the first round, and then Chicago never caught up again. Tampa's up to be like fine where Chicago wasn't, and you know they're not going to trade their Panarin, but like it's,
I think the Leafs are a worse team right now than they were at this time last year.
I think with Toronto, it's not even about the quality of the team itself at this point.
It never
Toronto
has been.
Toronto is this, exists outside of every other North American sports team right now. And what the hell is going on in the playoffs? They're on some like historic
generation
should be
stuff.
Studied for psychology shit right now. Like that, this is incredible. And they actually kind of got the monkey off the back last year and just lost to a team that was so good to go three times in a row. It's like there's motivation thus to prove it and more of just anger. And sometimes that can work, especially with hockey players. These guys are pretty good at channeling being pissed off into efficiency, and they have all of the talent to win. Like, marginal differences aside, that core is that core.
Yeah.
Goalie play and goalie stop puck, Toronto shoot good, Toronto win. And it doesn't seem that crazy. Every ounce of this I hate from my core. I actually hate the idea of Toronto winning. I live in the heart of this nation. Like, Leafs Nation, I will never hear the end of it. And it's fine. I've made my peace with it. But like,
they need to play Morgan Riley as little as humanly possible if they want to win that series.
Maybe. They just need to play Morgan Riley in specific situations with certain people.
Power play.
But like, Riley's still a good like 5v5 player. Like, he can put Morgan Riley out there with Matthews and Marner and stuff. It's like defensive mistakes happen and they'll go on the highlight reel. But like, it's a possession game, and you're getting more with Riley possessing the puck and then getting it to their top six, and the top six just being like, oh,
Giordano's
by the way,
been fantastic.
Yeah, see, like, Toronto's just got adaptable options on defense to play around with. They'll be fine, I think. And if they don't, then we get more memes. Like, it's a loser.
I think
it's a losing situation if you're Toronto at this point, or I guess it's like a winning one. I don't know. Toronto is just undefinable. They're undefinable. I don't know. But that's why, for once, I'm sitting there, I'm like, shit, you guys might do it.
Yeah.
Feels different.
And the defense is finally actually coming together now with Sandin and Lundgren actually developing into very good NHL players. Like, it's,
always going to
be the case.
Leaf fans were dragging them staying in the minors and not coming up and not getting them. And it's just like, I don't know. Toronto took their time with them, and it's
paid off.
It's paid off. So, like, you can't.
Taking your time with players seems to be working with.
You take your time with players like 99% of the time. You almost never. NHL is too good to rush players. Like, nobody in this draft should be playing except for Bedard next year. But like, multiple Ken. Probably no one. I don't.
Carlson. No, Carlson over Fantilli in terms of NHL readiness.
I agree with that. I think both could do it. Both could do it. Both would be fine. Both wouldn't have their development harmed. I think I'm just getting to the point where it's like, shit, if you don't play in the NHL, just go away for a year and just come back with like a monstrous killer instinct out of perfecting everything for a year.
With a guy like Carlson, I wonder how much development is left, because he's like,
there's a lot of development left.
There's a lot.
It's the mental. It's problem solving too. Like, there's just there's adaptive levels skill. To this stuff. Adaptive skill.
He's a grown up, and I'm saying that as a guy who's months younger than him.
Physical development. Sure, he might not get bigger, but that doesn't mean that he can't develop mentally and how he processes the game and what he does. I'm not concerned with Matt at all in terms of development strategy. There's a reason.
He
has a long runway still. He has a long runway.
Carlson has. Leo Carlson is everything Habs fans want Slafkovský to be. That's what everything they've talked about all summer is what Leo Carlson is, except Carlson doesn't have the physical dominance that Slafkovský has.
But he can play center.
Yeah, he does. He can. Carlson has all of the room to add that to his game still.
EP almost put Carlson in two.
But like Leo is still years away from being at his peak in terms of physical performance anyways, not to mention like all the tools are going to get refined a little bit, the mental processing can get better, but like he already is a ridiculous open ice attacker. Like Carlson could be 6 feet and no one would have any issues with him. He'd work as the same player most of the time. At World Junior, he showed us he was able to be the physical guy a lot more there, but in the SHL, you know, he's more of an open space guy. Either way, it's like 5 years from now, he's going to be a monster of a power forward, and he's going to have every bit of this open ice skill and play driving ability. And when that all comes together, it's terrifying. It's just ridiculous that Adam Fantilli has the same argument and is even more terrifying. That's just like I love Crystal to death. I keep saying Crystal's the first player like I've watched in 3 or 4 years where the thought of, I don't think you're going to do it and I wouldn't bet on it. But if you turn out to be a 100-point player at some point in your career,
I absolutely agree.
I wouldn't be surprised. I realized I don't think that's ever been a thought that didn't sound absurd about any player in the last few drafts, and it feels absurd for everyone in this draft, including Crystal. But if I'm making that bet, it's gonna be him. I think like he's kind of insane, but he's not that, like that tiny chance of happening is probably not worth passing over Carlson, who could be like a 70-point two-way monster.
I have Tristel
dominates 5v5
with Carlson, Benson, and Michkov. Because I don't know, like I just kind of have a feeling that he's gonna put up like 90 points 1 year.
Like Zach Benson is a guy that I think we could also talk about. It's just like I don't know if there's a single player in this draft class that plays the game of hockey better than Zach Benson. And I'm not saying is the best player in the draft class. I'm just saying
I get what you mean.
Every fundamental in hockey, he aces. Everything I look for as a scout, every box I try to tick, everything I want players to be refined in, he does exceptionally well. And that's why I had him ranked third overall. But again, it's a coin flip with Carlson and a coin flip with Michkov and a coin flip with Crystal. Like that tier to me, you put in the blender and it works just fine. I just ended up putting Benson at three just because I think that you have a slam dunk top six center with him, which
like as a D minus one, he was the best player on a team with two top 12 picks.
Yes, he was. He was like, better than Savoy last year. He was.
Absolutely. And I mean, you guys know how I feel about Savoy, but
yeah,
regardless.
He's everything you guys said and probably more. The one teeny thing about Benson is there is a legitimate question of tools, and when you have him relative to these names, like
the skating and explosiveness is my main concern there.
That's the one I'm not concerned with.
Like the actual explosiveness of his movements. Like he, I don't know, whenever he tries to like kind of like explosively get around defenders, he fails miserably at it, but because he thinks the game is such a high level, he doesn't need to have that skill.
Yeah, it's just, I also like, I look at Benson, I don't see a reason why he can't be a bit faster. Like he's one of those players where it's like you look at him and it's just like, is there anything inherently wrong with your skating? Sweet, can you get stronger? Yes. All right, so your skating's gonna get better. That's just like, that's kind of like how development
works. It has in the last calendar year.
And then as well as like progress through this year, it's like Benson skating has gotten better. Like believe he was just like a random pick in the WHL. He wasn't that high and he showed up and everyone was like, wait, what? This kid can do it at this level too. Cause the whole thing with him was like, oh, he doesn't have the tools for the dub. I heard this from Joel Henderson, who is like about as reliable a WHL source as you can.
Yeah,
he's like, I might be misquoting it, but it was, he showed up in the dub and everyone who watched the dub draft basically was like, yeah, he's a genius. He's just gonna struggle because he doesn't have the tools. And then he showed up and they were like, oh wait, he's smarter than everyone in this league too. Shit. Okay. I guess that works. So then now he's on his current path. This time it's like, well, you're going to the NHL. Your tools aren't, like, the tools to be a first line player aren't there. And at some point, mental ability can only take you so far. Whether it's fair or not, you can get away with some blatant calls in the NHL. And like, players like Benson are the type of guys who struggle with that. And it's something you should account for, even if like you don't, but like,
yeah,
all it takes is a little bit of speed, which he's like guaranteed to get, and the right line mates. That's the other thing. He's got to play with the right people. Not that Benson can't be effective in any line, but if you're drafting Benson at like top five, which I want to do because I have him top five, I want peak skill Zach Benson, and peak skill Zach Benson wants to play with Suzuki and Caulfield and play like combinations like that out there. And he is going to be disgusting when he does it, and could at times be the line driver by just being the 5v5 macro controller. It's like, he's not manipulating guys one-on-one to the same extent, but he's like the one manipulating offensive and defensive structures as a whole, just by like where he is and his timing with his movements, decisions he makes, how he attacks defenders, the tiniest gaps he can open just through off puck movement, and just through like second efforts on the forecheck with defensive sticks and stuff like that, and offensive and stick lifts. Just, it's everything. Like, you can just list every single thing, and he has it all, and he can do it all. He single-handedly made multiple players at the Hlinka get a lot of hype coming into the season that is not looking pretty warranted at this point, I think. And it's, you go back and you watch that tape, and the first thing you're thinking is like, well, there it is right there. It's a Zach Benson show. He was a god amongst men at that tournament. There was no player like him or even remotely close to him. He stood alone above everybody. And it's pretty much been that trend going forward. Crystal has just managed to just be equally as ridiculous in the WHL.
All right. Two of my personal favorite players that are going to be available in the second round are one I've been raving about all season long, and that's Luca Pinelli, who I have ranked. Like, Sam, you were saying that you have no guys that you're like absurdly high on relative to consensus. Pinelli is that guy for me. I have him ranked 15th overall. I haven't seen anyone else. He's very good.
He was almost like that for Scout on one of his streams. I don't think he's that high.
He dropped to like I think late first round, which is more what I'd expect for most people to have him ranked. And the other player I like a lot is very different, but Oscar Fisker Molgaard, who is like a mini Lekkonen, and I love him. He's great.
I saw your tweet about that earlier. I thought that I almost always look at a player comparable and I'm like, sure. But that one I was like,
I typically don't shit. Make comparables because I don't like them.
I see
because
that.
Every player is like unique. But Molgaard, again, not draft your Lekkonen. Draft your Lekkonen was this offensive force and was not a defense-first player. But Oscar Fisker Molgaard has that same intensity and the defensive habits and structure they love to play and works wonderfully. The forecheck is suffocating. He's doing this in the SHL. He's putting up good 5-on-5 points in the SHL for draft eligible. He's really quick. He has a good shot and he knows how to get in position to use it. He's a decent playmaker. Like, he's so well-rounded, and he plays this super high tempo game against men. And again, whenever I've watched him, I would just think like, oh, that brings me joy. I wonder why. And then I think back and I'm like, that's kind of like Lekkonen. And yeah, he's very fun.
Yeah. He's pretty much agree with everything you said. He's one of it was him and Mukhanov were the last two players that I've like added to this section of the list. Cause I started
me too. Yeah.
Yeah. I started with like 45 guys this year. And then I just kind of focused on them instead of consistently branching out for once. And I gotta say, OFM is really, really smart. He's like the ultimate player to have as a late first round pick. He's gonna play. He's gonna be really impactful in a lot of ways. He's the type of guy who, when someone pulls out a Jay Fresh card, like it's a Yu-Gi-Oh card to win a duel,
oh, it's gonna be blue.
It's gonna light up blue. Shiny. Like, he's the analytical darling. He's not your play driver. He's not, you're not drafting him for that type of stuff. He's not the upside guy, but he's the, I'm still a really good player anyways. And it's like, it sounds like the less appealing pick, but in a lot of ways, it's like almost the more appealing pick for in a way. Like, OFM is the line elevator. Escalator. He's the slowly moving stairs. He is the guy who you put on a third line, second line, first line if the fit is right, but like you're not hoping for that.
If you strike gold like Lekkonen in Colorado.
That's 100. I was just about to say, like, Lekkonen with McKinnon and McCarr works. Or McCarr? McKinnon and Rantanen. Sorry.
McCarr could be a forward and he'd be just fine. Like,
yeah, he would do fine, but Lekkonen with McKinnon and Rantanen like makes sense because those two guys
powerful,
are so skilled.
And
you want OFM with those type of guys if he's not playing on the first. I think he's going to be a pretty strong second line guy, if I'm to make the guess. Like a second line guy that you put in with better second line players. But he's also going to, it's this weird paradoxical statement where it's like you want him on the second line, even though he's not a second line player, because you want to play with guys who are better second line players. But they're going to be better because of him, but he's still not the main guy on the line. Is this weird?
Because he is up and down. He would be a line elevator, like you were saying, right? Like you put him in there as like a performance boost for the other guys, which then
allows his own players to play their best game.
Yes, yeah, I think that's the summary right there. I think that's pretty. There are like some concerns. Like you can have the conversation about like, oh, is this part of his game going to work? Are the tools projectable enough? Is he going to be able to make dangerous passes and things like this? Like you can go down that thought path, but it's like it circles back to like, what are you drafting him for? Because that's not what I would be drafting OFM for. Like I'm drafting him and making him the jack of all trades, Swiss Army knife. Like,
yeah,
can do everything and anything you need from him, and your coach will absolutely love you for drafting him when he's in the lineup 4 or 5 years later, and he's just awesome. He's gonna have like a big role in the World Juniors in a couple of years. He's gonna look awesome at the tournament. People are going to start recognizing him, and it's going to have like a Lekkonen kind of rise from it. Hopefully. I mean, he's definitely smart enough for it. And that the intelligence and the ability to read the game and play a support role at this age is rare. Like to this extent, it's rare. It's mature in a way that you don't often see. You're often looking for players with like, who have maturity in their game, and you're hoping to like, can continue on that trend. Whereas he's like, I play pro hockey right now. I don't need to change it. I just need to like tighten it up and get a little bit better with my tools. And hopefully everyone I play with just kind of feeds off that type of play style and everything kind of clicks and connects. Like line
and that complementary skill is also something that can be developed for another 8 years.
Yeah, it's just keeps getting better. Yeah. It's little details that get added each year, especially when you're playing at the highest level.
Yeah, and then going back to my personal adopted son in the draft class, Luca Pinelli. I don't think the listeners need me to talk about him because I have at length many times already. But in summary, I have him ranked 15th overall because I love the way his brain ticks, and I think he has some really dynamic offensive abilities. There are very few players in this draft class that are more versatile in their transition game, their offensive transition game, than Pinelli is, and few that are as good as he is at getting pucks from the board to the middle. I love that you can build like a foundation around those tools, those habits, and And yeah, like he has a great shot. He's a better playmaker. I like his defensive involvement. Overall, I'm just very, very frustrated that even with a lack of centers right now for Ottawa, with Vinny Rohrer out with injury, and there was a game I went to where even Logan Morrison was out with injury, they still refuse to play him at center, which is confounding to me because he played center last year and was amazing doing it, and this year has not gotten a single second of time at center, and his game is made to play down the middle, and I will die on that hill. I think he is a center. I think he's a very good winger, but I think he'd be better down the middle. But what's your take on Pennelly?
Really similar. My thing with Pennelly is that I have had a couple of games where just like I don't see it ticking as well. Like you can. No, that's not right. You see the brain ticking the same way.
He needs the right line. Like Pennelly yes. with Rohrer and Boucher beginning of the season was absolutely absurd. Boucher was doing all of the physical dirty work, and he was actually doing that very, very effectively, just like we saw him do at the World Juniors. Like this year, Tyler Boucher has been playing some very, very good OHL hockey, despite the production not being like overly glamorous. Yep. And Vinny Rohrer has come so far in the last, like over the summer, like his development over the summer has been insane.
Yes.
So much more dynamic, way better use of his physicality, really improved every single tool in his toolkit. And absolutely. That top line just ticks tremendously well. One thing I'd love to see them try out would be, I mean, obviously not now with Rohrer out, but I would have liked to see Stonehouse on the top line with them just to kind of substitute Boucher's physicality and the forechecking.
I love Brady Stonehouse so much.
I am captaining the Brady Stonehouse.
Stonehouse train. My favorite player to watch on the Invis team.
Yes, so it's the best sibling duo. It's an amazing sibling duo. But yeah, that top line works tremendously well. And one of the reasons I really questioned myself with having Pennelly as high as I did is that because he needs that, not needs, but in order to optimize what Pennelly is, you need him on that line of complementary players rather than just plug and play. He can be effective while plugging him into any line, but in order to optimize his skill set, you need that. He cannot be the primary driver. He cannot be the primary forechecker. Despite both those things being strengths in his game, he works best when he is kind of the trailer on the line and he can see the entire play develop in front of him. But yeah, I'm a very, very big fan of his game.
I am a big fan of Pennelly. He's one I think will go higher and not lower because he's 24. I need to change that font. That font is ugly. He is 24. I am a big fan of him for just about every reason you said. I take back what I said earlier. His brain is always ticking in the same direction. You can always see him trying to set up the same place. I am in the middle of figuring out a problem with Pennelly, which is kind of like where I am and why he's a little at 24 right now. He could maybe go a little lower if it goes the other way, but I think it's going to end up being in his favor and he goes higher. I can't discern yet if Pennelly is struggling in some games because he's not good at creating the conditions he wants out there. Not that he's not good, but he's not consistently creating the conditions he wants out there, and the games he's doing really well and is those like the line as a whole are creating the conditions for him and he thrives. Like that kind of goes off what you said, like when he's with the right players on the right line, he snaps, it's incredible, and he's like play driving. And it's not necessarily a punishment because you hope that Pennelly would be like Pennelly's playing with high pace smart players in the NHL that will consistently be able to make these plays for him. I do think if Pennelly gets kind of taken out of that rhythm a little bit and he has to go out of his way to kind of do a little bit more for himself, he doesn't look as good. How much of a problem that is, I don't know yet. I'm starting to lean more back towards it's not that big a problem for what I just said about like other teammates in the NHL are just going, like he's in the NHL, they're all smart, they all play with pace. Yeah. That's not really a problem. The other thing, the question that does concern me a bit more is like, he's not likely to be the primary guy in the NHL.
No.
how is he in a supporting role with other players, but it's not so much something you can really discern from like where he is this year, because he's not going to be in that environment. And it's one of those, like, again, you can go back to like, you can start really question, you start making questions like that and focus them on Pennelly, and you're not doing it with other players, and you're biasly going against them. So like, this is where I'm at with Pennelly. It's this weird like question limbo and answer limbo phase where I'm like, I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt, even if the ranking doesn't show it, and I'm expecting him to move up, but I'm not all there yet. And some of the questions I'm asking, I might not get clear answers for. So I have to like, because I can't get the clear answers where I'm still in this figuring out stage. I don't know. He's super interesting. I could be completely down to revisit this conversation towards year's end when like these reads are pretty clear and like kind of just done for the year. He's one of the few where I'm still like, I don't know. I think he's definitely, the one thing I know is he's definitely capable of being an NHL player, which I mean, for like, sure. Of course he's a first round pick. Like, you better think that, but like, he's not some crazy long shot, and like some rankings have him pretty low.
Yeah.
Like, I know Brock Otten ran his OHL poll and he said
that was surprising to me.
Yeah. Two or three people had Pennelly one, and multiple or two or three had him like out of the top 10. And it's like, that variance does feel a little extreme to me, because I don't think, like, unless the bulk of the argument is 5'9", small size scale threshold, he down here, no, then okay. But even then, it's like, I'd still rather take the chance.
He plays a really tenacious and engaged physical game, and he uses his low center of gravity to win a lot of puck battles. Like, he's very, very sturdy, just never gets like bodied off the puck. My biggest, I guess, question mark with Pennelly is purely how he's been used this season. And it's frustrating to me because he's been benched multiple times for taking like one not great penalty, and been benched for entire periods of play, which has never been the same case for any other player on the team. At least players in like the top six or top four. And it's been really confounding of just like, why are you treating one of your most skilled players like this? Also now with the, like when Logan Morrison was acquired, even with Vincent Rohr out with injury, Pennelly was not on the first power play unit. They put Brad Gardner in there instead. And there's so many decisions here where it's like, okay, clearly the coach is not optimizing the situations for Pennelly, despite Pennelly playing over 18 minutes the entire season, basically, per game. The actual situational use of him, because I've watched so many more games of Pennelly than any other player in this draft class. Like, I've been to 30 plus live viewings of Pennelly over the last year and a half, which, again, I'm not comparing to like video viewings, because I value video viewings way more in terms of actually deciphering how a player ticks and how they play.
Oh, but I get it. There's value in both. Like, there's
there for sure is.
It's good when a player is good at both.
Exactly. Yeah. And the live viewings of the 30 I've had, including last season, and there's a very, very clear improvement over the off season, like really clear. But in every single viewing, I'm just like, I love the way he plays the game. I love the way he thinks the game. I love the decisions he makes. I love the processing speed he has. And then this season, it's just the usage is just so weird. Even when he was playing on the top line, that was dominant. It was by far the best line in the entire OHL when it was together. There were shifts where the coach would just bench Pennelly for one or two shifts for no apparent reason. And it's just like, these are the times where I'd love to have more of an inside scoop.
Yeah, I was just wondering that.
I have a few inside scoops of how the room is in Ottawa. Yeah, I'm not going to speak on that, but it is telling a bit of like why this might be happening. But it wasn't actually about Pennelly specifically; it was more just how the room is run as a whole. That's my biggest question mark, because I feel like if Pennelly were in an optimized position, he would be the clear best player in this OHL draft class.
I think
already have him as the clear top OHL prospect, but I know I'm almost on an island with that take.
I get where you're coming from. I do think there's one concern people have with Pennelly, and I do have, this is one I meant to bring up sooner, especially because it kind of does go along with one of the things you said as a strength. Like, he is one of, there's two things that you said that are both entirely true and could very well work out for him and could also be the reason it doesn't work at the same time, which is why it's a little scary. One is he is surprisingly good at physical play for a 5'9 guy at his size. Two, he's really good at bringing pucks in from the middle, from the boards. That is a very good combination, but he's also 5'9", and he's also small.
Yeah.
And NHL guys are huge, and you need, like, Gavin Brindley's puck protection mechanics and the way he handles it. Yeah. Like, it's puck protection, which, like, that puck protection, I can see smaller guys having advantages with. Straight up physical engagements are another matter entirely, and they're almost like physics are physics.
Yeah, of course.
You're gonna, like, once the playing field is even and Pennelly's going up against the behemoths of this league, those battles aren't getting won anymore for the most part, and he has everything he needs to adapt to that, and he also has what it takes to just become better with puck protection as a whole, where it's less about, like, I will just, like, oh yeah, let's go, like, just, like, take him on, go shoulder in, extend his right arm out with the puck, and more so, okay, I'm just gonna shift away, pivot, puck at full reach, just keep as much distance, shield with the body, you know, just the differences of, like, carrying for puck protection and, like, engaging in contact to gain space. Those two, there's a fine line. I don't even know if I'm properly describing it right, but there is a fine line between two of what I'm trying to say. And I think Pennelly kind of strides on it. He goes one way, it's a boom. He goes the other way, well, it's going to be really hard to see him taking pucks in from the inside if he's losing every physical battle. And the second that part of his game is gone, he's out of the NHL. He's not playing. And it's like, that's, I think, where the general concern is. I'm still lean with the point where I'm not concerned, but with Pennelly, unlike Brindley, I see where the concern is coming from.
Yeah. They are in two different tiers for me. Like, I have Brindley a very clear tier above Pennelly.
I agree, that's
not really in doubt for me. It's more of a thing of, like, okay, Pennelly is also, like, it's also a thing of, like, I just absolutely love the way Pennelly plays. And I'm like, it might not be the most rational decision, but again, it's a midterm board right now for me. But I'm just,
yeah, everyone's still figuring out stage.
I'm hedging my bets on him right now. I love the way he plays the game. And it's like, okay, by the end of the season, I'll have a more serious, like internal monologue on the risk reward factor with Pennelly. But for the time being, I also just kind of want to plant my flag as, like, I love this player. I'm going to stick to this. I can point back to this in a few years if it turns out well, or I look kind of dumb for having him this high right now. Either way, I'm comfortable doing it. But it's the end of season board where I'll really have that thought process of, like, okay, do I really want to have him over a guy like William Whitelaw, who has a significantly higher ceiling, right? And then conversely, do I want to have him higher than a guy like, I think I have him ahead of who else? Obviously Braden Yeager and Nate Danielson and other names that are, like, more shoo-ins for, like, third line roles. And it's like, okay, but where is the middle ground with Pennelly, right? Of, like, okay, I have him ahead of guys with higher upside and with higher floors. What do I think Pennelly will be, right? But that's something where, even now, because I totally see where you're coming from, where he's a tough nut to crack, like, in terms of how you value him.
Difficult read right now.
And I'm struggling with it, and I've watched him 30 plus times live, right? Like, plus another, like, 5 or 6 video viewings. Like, I've watched a lot of Luca Pennelly, and I can still totally see any outcome here, right? Because it's not a question of what he is now. It's can he do what he does at the next level? And that is a very tough question. That
yep. Projectability with him is just that it's always whenever a player is as hard to read the slate in the air, it's still the projectability conversation. And there's you're subject to 50 different subjective takes. All of them can be valid if argued by the right person. And it just turns into this big complex web of interconnecting problems that need solving. And it's just it's almost like that's a textbook example of why players like him sometimes fall, because they're just like, yeah, he might work out, but I don't want it. You know, it's just like, I'll take someone else. Now, you don't pass on him to draft a guy who you literally can get like for 1.3 mil every single year in the offseason, but you do take Nate Danielson above him. Yeah, I can see it. You take, like, who do I have right below him? Like, Oscar Fisker Molgaard. I can 100% see that. Charlie Strammel. I can see it. Timur Mukhanov. I have above him. So, yes, I can see that.
Like the names I have right behind Pennelly are probably all guys that you have a tier above, I would assume. Dmitry Simashev, Riley Height, Dalibor Dvorsky, Will Whitelaw, and Luca Cagnoni. Like, that's
Simashev, Height, and Cagnoni are literally 12, 13, 14 for me.
Yeah. So that's the thing for me of like, okay, I have him in that tier that goes down to Will Whitelaw of, okay, I could have had him 19th overall just fine, but I kind of just wanted to plant my flag. And that was, again, it's a midterm ranking. It's going to change, right? Like, if we were to look back at our preliminary rankings, like, we'd laugh because things change over time so much. But yeah, I think on that note, we're going to conclude the episode just so it's not the absolute editing nightmare that it already is for Aaron. But good luck, buddy. I wish you luck with the editing. I'm sorry.
I don't need luck. I need an assistant. But
but on that note, thanks so much for coming on, Sam. This was a very, very fun
episode.
Thank
you for having me.
And yeah, thanks, Aaron and Josh, for being here as always. And on that note, we'll see you again next week. And thanks so much for listening.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure. Syracuse.